If I could proceed, I'd like to present a couple of facts. Mr. Stewart was a small businessman for a number of years making gun kits that he advertised nationally in gun publications, and these were target shooting of 50 caliber rifles. And he didn't sell them as a gun, he sold them as a gun kit, wherein part of it needed to be rifled, or the receiver needed to be changed and rifled in order to make it into a weapon where the bullet was put into the barrel. Without that part of it, it's not a firearm, because it's not defined, because it cannot expel a projectile. It happened one day that one of his weapons was being machined in a machine shop across town, and there was an agent in there who said, you know, I really think that's readily convertible under the statute, and it just might be a violation. So he went over and bought one from Mr. Stewart, or one of his agents did, and went and sent it back to Washington and said, yes, can this be readily converted? And the agent back there in the laboratory converted it into, in about 30 minutes, at least, until it would expel a blank, at least, although it was not fully adjusted. And they sent it back to Phoenix and obtained a search warrant and went into Mr. Stewart's property and found quite a bit more than just 50 caliber weapons, weapon kits. They found machine guns, they found 26 rifles and pistols, and they found quite a variety of things. What's unique about the case in one respect is that the government never pursued the 50 caliber kits being, in fact, firearms. They simply dropped that issue when they found, I guess, the gold road of all of the other weapons. At that time, I was appointed to represent Mr. Stewart initially, and upon his release, upon his release by the magistrate prior to trial, he did retain a private counsel who argued the search warrant issue. And the essential search warrant issue was whether or not they could have a hearing under Franks versus Delaware. They challenged the search warrant on the premise that the statute was vague, that what readily converted means is too arguable to issue a search warrant over under 18 U.S. Code 921A3. They contended that the was false and misleading information set forth in the search warrant affidavit, in that the tools needed to readily convert this weapon and the time taken were not factually correct, and that there were material omissions from the affidavit of the search warrant, namely that whether you can assemble the weapon as a weapon or whether you can completely assemble it was a point of argument. And the defense asked for a hearing in order to develop that issue by cross-examination of the agents, as well as perhaps presenting other testimony from their own experts, of which Mr. Stewart is certainly probably one.
Well, a Franks hearing usually tests veracity.
Pardon?
Not really. A Franks hearing usually tests veracity.
All right.
Right. And you really weren't challenging veracity. You're not saying that agents lied here. You're saying that they didn't say quite enough.
Well, one could...
And that strikes me as a question of law, whether they said enough to establish probable cause.
Well, one could possibly misrepresent by omission as well. And this is what the defense wished to present at that hearing, was that there were a lot more facts that the magistrate should have known prior to issuing a warrant, based upon the fact that these were long sold gun kits advertised in national publications for many years without ever having been molested by any agents of the government. And
what does that have to do?
Well, it would have to do with it that they could have developed that on the Franks hearing and possibly had some success at it, or perhaps no success at it. At least they would have had that hearing and we wouldn't have had this issue.
All right, but let's say they held the hearing. What good would it have done you? Let's say they had, in fact, presented this evidence. Why is this evidence that should have been presented to the magistrate?
I don't quite understand the question.
The point of a Franks hearing is to say, look, there's evidence that was either presented untruthfully to the magistrate or that was omitted. And if only the magistrate had been given truthful or complete information, this would have made a difference the warrant should not have or would not have issued.
The truthfulness is,
I guess I don't understand how showing that these guns kits have been sold for years are molested, what bearing that would have.
Well, because to be readily converted to a weapon would have taken a lot more tools and a lot more time than were and did take a lot more tools and a lot more time.
There was evidence that they were able to convert them in 30 minutes. Now, you can contest that evidence, you can cross-examine, you can, but I don't see how, for purposes of establishing probable cause, what good of facts hearing. I mean, Charlie might be able to do something with that, but what possible good would a facts hearing do you?
Because the defense would have brought out that it took more tools and more time to convert that kit into a rifle, and therefore the magistrate should have known those facts, and had he known those facts, the magistrate may have concluded that this was not a search warrant issue.
You're claiming that the agent who said he converted it in 30 minutes lied?
In order to have an operable weapon, it takes much more than 30 minutes because after working on the receiver from the machinist's point of view, the weapon has to be, the headspace has to be adjusted, and the other procedures have to be done in order to finish it. And the only projectile.
That's for the gold filigree on the button.
That's correct. And the only projectile that they tested it with was a blank.
Usually, if you can shoot a blank, you can shoot a slug.
Yes, that was the contention.
I've never seen an exception.
That was the contention. And had they had that hearing, they may have been able to present that information and been successful at it. Or that issue would not be here with us today.
You're down to 2 minutes and 44 seconds.
There are a couple of other issues.
Anything else?
Yes, a couple of other issues that need to be presented on the firearms. The second issue on appeal is the firearms. These machine guns never traveled in interstate commerce. They were basically made in this machinist's garage. And the case decided in at least my reply brief and by the government, U.S. versus Rambo, distinctly says you cannot have unlawful possession without unlawful transfer. There was no transfer of these weapons. They were made in the garage.
Out of what?
And never left. Out of what?
Yes.
Out of metal, out of gun, out of steel that he had available, and
so raw steel?
I don't know that he made it out of raw steel. For instance, in some parts of it, the handle grip was purchased as a gross of handle grips that were also used on the 50 caliber weapon. They used the same one to make the machine gun. And purchased a barrel and from a supply house and put the barrel on it. But the machine part of it, the receiver part, that is the machine gun, was actually manufactured by this individual.
Out of what, a block of metal?
A partially completed receiver.
I thought this was stems that were imported from Canada somehow.
They're not imported. Did you say imported? They're not imported. They were actually the machine gun part of it were actually made by him, and there was never any other contention by the government or anyone that they were traveled in interstate commerce in any fashion as a machine gun. The third issue that...
But doesn't Rambo stand for the proposition that the transfer itself is commerce without proof of interstate commerce?
But there was no transfer.
But there was in the one that he sold to the agent.
He didn't sell a machine gun to the agent. He sold it.
Okay, so that gets back to the ultimate question. Was it a machine gun?
No, it wasn't a machine gun. He sold the agent a 50 caliber rifle kit.
Oh, the rifle kit. That's, sorry.
The machine guns were found as a result of the search warrant. They were never displayed or advertised and so forth as far as we know. And in Rambo...
So he owned the machine guns and he made them.
That is correct.
That's what you think that shows.
That is correct, and that's where we go to the Interstate Commerce Commission issue.
Now some of that stuff must have traveled. The barrel must have traveled to interstate commerce.
I don't think there's any contention that some of the parts may have traveled in interstate commerce. He bought them from an outfit in Carolina in bulk, triggers in bulk, stocks in bulk, barrels from Germany. No doubt about that. But the machine gun part that allows it to repeat with only one function of the trigger was actually machined by the defendant. The last issue that I wanted to bring up was...
And all of those sales and purchases, the purchase and sale of the barrels and the triggers and the grips, are all legal?
Yes.
As far as the record shows?
Yes. They're bought from a wholesale house around the country, one of them in South Carolina, a very large one. And he advertised in a publication called Shotgun News, which is basically a national publication that is almost entirely advertising. I'll save any time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay, we'll hear from the government.
May it please the Court, my name is Fred Batista. I'm an assistant United States attorney with the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Arizona and with the Phoenix Division. With respect to the issue of the search warrant, it's the government's position that the defendant has waived any issues with respect to the search warrant because of the fact that the defendant did not brief the issue in his brief. The Court has presented several questions to the defendant with respect to what would have happened had there been a Franks hearing in this case. It's the government's position that a Franks hearing wasn't necessary. To elaborate on the facts a little bit in this case, the defendant was under investigation for selling kits that were bolt-action, single-fire, 50-caliber rifles. And before the execution of the search warrant, that was all the defendant was under investigation for. At that time, the defendant had a prior federal felony conviction for possession of Sten machine guns from the District of Utah. The case agent bought one of the kits. He sent it off for examination. The firearms expert that assembled the weapon made a determination that it took him 35 minutes to assemble the receiver of the gun. The receiver, Your Honors, in this case, basically imagine a piece of, would look very similar to automobile exhaust tubing. A higher grade, but literally just straight metal pipe with several cutouts in it. The defendant was selling it with the cutouts partially made out. You could see the cutouts in the receiver. All you'd have to do, either with hand tools, a Dremel tool, or with machine equipment, finish the cutouts, and you would have a firearm receiver. One of the things that the defendant does not highlight and avoids is the issue that under the definition of firearms in Section Title 18, Section 921, the definition includes the receiver of a firearm. A receiver in and of itself is a firearm. So once that, under the federal law, once that receiver is milled out, and there was testimony that it took approximately 35 minutes to mill out the receiver, you have a firearm. Issues about whether or not it needs to be assembled or how long it takes to be assembled or how accurate it is once it's assembled are, in a sense, irrelevant.
It's a firearm because it can propel a projectile?
No, Your Honor. If you look under Section 921A, there's a definition of the firearm, and included in the definitions as a separate definition is the receiver of a firearm. In other words, for purposes of the definition of purposes of federal law, once you have a completed receiver, you have a firearm. You need not go any farther. So in a sense, if this defendant had no other parts except this 50-caliber rifle receiver, if he was making those and shipping them interstate and been engaged in a regular course of business of doing that, he would be in violation of federal law for engaging in the business of dealing in firearms without a license, even though he never sold any other parts.
So the thing that he actually sold was not a receiver without the milling.
It needed 30 minutes, 35 minutes, Your Honor, of additional milling. So
the question then became whether that was so minimal.
Mm-hmm. Would this item be something that could be readily converted? Now, the defendant in the district court below discussed the Second Circuit opinion, Maslow, in that case, there were small caliber starter pistols, which were converted in 12 minutes. and the defendant seeks to, in a sense, make 12 minutes as a benchmark of, well, if it takes longer than 12 minutes, it's not really convertible. But what we're talking about here is 50 caliber long-range rifles versus starter pistols. So, in a sense, the court had all the information before to make a finding that the magistrate had all the information before to make a finding that it took approximately 35 minutes to make a firearm. The only thing that the agent did not mention in his affidavit was the fact that once the receiver was complete, it took an additional 30 minutes to assemble the complete firearm and make it functional.
The question of whether this was close enough to a receiver to have it be a receiver, who makes that decision and by what standard? I mean, let's say I look at it and say, wow, 35 minutes of machining sounds to me like a lot.
I think,
you know, have to use one of those dangerous Dremel tools, you know. It's beyond my ability to do that. So that to me sounds like it's very powerful. Let's say that's how I think. What happens then?
I think, Your Honor, what we have in the firearms area, it's kind of, you have to look really on a case-by-case basis because it's,
I'm asking a different question.
Okay.
The reason they got a warrant is it persuaded a magistrate judge that this was illegal.
Correct.
That things were illegal, and they were illegal because they were essentially receivers.
They were readily convertible into.
Readily convertible.
Yes, Your Honor.
And let's say I just look at it and I say, gee, I don't think the magistrate judge really got it right on that. I think this is not readily receivable. I think it's this. It's not readily convertible. I think it's convertible only with difficulty.
Mm-hmm. Well, Your Honor.
What happens then?
Well, I think, Your Honor, if the court were to do that, I think that the ultimate fallback, would be the good faith exception. In other words, all the information was presented.
But I think you skipped over something. That would then defeat the probable cause. And then the question is, the warrant is gone and we have to fall back
And obviously, Your Honor, if the magistrate were to make a determination that the firearms were not readily convertible based upon the information contained in the affidavit, there would be no probable cause. But in this case, the included in the affidavit were the defendant's own statements that the weapon was 75% complete, that it was foolproof to assemble.
Well, we don't know 75% of what. You know, 75% of lifting a ton is still 25%.
Well, Your Honor,
it's still more than I can lift. So saying it's 75% complete doesn't tell you anything at all because you don't know what the 100% amounts to and what is involved in the remaining 25%.
But that statement was not made in isolation. The defendant, there was also information in the defense that it was foolproof to assemble, that it could only be assembled one way, that you could do it yourself. That his own advertisement said assembly within 30 minutes. So it was not this. We have a situation here, Your Honor, when the defendant is marketing the gun, when he wants to get your money, it's easy to assemble, no problem, anybody can do it.
What is the law? I mean, the law prohibits the sale of receivers, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And where does this part that says readily convertible come from? Is it in the statute?
It's in the same definition, Your Honor, the definition of a firearm in Title 18, Section 921.
Do we have any case law interpreting what readily convertible means?
Well, Your Honor, there's a dearth of case law. There's not a lot of cases with respect to what, in this type of area, would be readily convertible. Again, the one case that the defendant did cite is the Moslow case from the Second Circuit, and that was a situation where
it's all vague for criminal law statute, isn't it? I mean, I realize that this is so vague. You're not here because the guy didn't decide not to go forward and try him for that. But it's a little vague for criminal statute if you ever try to really. You know, what is readily convertible?
Well, Your Honor,
one guy's readily convertible is another guy's nightmare.
And part of the problem is, Your Honor, is that the unique nature of firearms in that you can't.
I'm sorry?
One of the issues that we're dealing with, Your Honor, is the unique nation of firearms. In other words, there isn't really one size fits all. You can't say, well, you've got to be able to build this gun within 15 minutes, or you can only build it with vice grips in a file, but if you have to use a saw or a drill press, it's not readily convertible. Firearms are so, there's such a vast difference among firearms in terms of some, I mean, you can build a firearm, a pen gun, you could build it perhaps 15 minutes just going out into somebody's garage and you can build a gun. Or if you're building a long range 50 caliber rifle, that's going to take much work. So what are we talking about? Readily convertible to build a one shot pen gun that has a spring that you get from a big pen, or a 50 caliber rifle? I think.
Gee, I would think readily convertible means the same thing, regardless how complicated the ultimate piece of equipment is. It's easy to convert.
Well, and I think
easy should be easy for a simple piece of equipment, and easy should be easy for a more complicated piece of equipment too.
Well, and Your Honor, in this case, what this firearm was,
I don't know what bearing that has on the easy.
Well, let's look at the facts of this case. What you have is may I continue? I see I'm running out of time.
Sure.
Right. What you get, Your Honors, you have a receiver tube, and you'll have something, and this is your tube, and you'll have something that has to be cut out in order for the bolt to function. And what happens is this outline, I'll show, thanks, counsel, this outline is fully lined out in the receiver tube. But what happens is part of the metal is left in like this. So in other words, everything's done. All the parts are there. You don't need any, there's no instructions or anything. As Mr. Stewart tells him, all you got to do is you got to take a Dremel tool or a file or a machine equipment and just follow the line and just take that metal out, and that's all you got to do. And if you want to sit there with a hand file and do it, you'll have a 50 caliber rifle. If you want to get a Dremel tool from Sears, Black & Decker, grind that out, you got it. If you want to go to a machinist and have it done perfectly, take it to a machinist and he'll do it for you. But that's all we're talking about, Your Honor, is that the defendant is leaving a little bit of metal in the receiver because he's trying to get around the law. And that's what he's doing. That's readily convertible. That's all it is in this case, is we've got, he's leaving a little piece of metal there, tells you just follow the lines, grind it out, and you're done. And once you do that, as he tells all his customers, it's foolproof, it's easy, anybody can do it. It only goes together one way. You just put everything together, you put a bullet in it, and you fire it. And that's what was told to the magistrate. The magistrate found probable cause. They went to the defendant's house. They found 5 Sten machine guns and 26.
Nevertheless, you didn't prosecute for that.
Well, and why didn't we prosecute for that? Because then I, who prosecuted the case, didn't have to stand before a jury and argue back and forth what is readily convertible. Obviously, it's an issue. But why do that when you have a defendant who has a prior felony conviction for possessing Sten machine guns, has 5 more Sten machine guns in his garage, and he's got 26 firearms in his bedroom?
No, I can certainly understand why you went for the other stuff, but my experience is the government charges everything it thinks it can get away with proving.
Well, Your Honor,
you must not have failed to charge that because it's not so easy to prove before the jury. Because you said, you know, you have to sit there and explain to the jury whether it is readily or not readily convertible. What about those machine guns? Those machine guns sound to me like they haven't traveled through interstate commerce. I think you've got a problem.
Well, Your Honor,
you got a problem there, no?
I don't think I have a problem. But let me back up one step, Your Honor, and state that I've been a prosecutor for over 10 years, and I've charged hundreds of gun cases. And I can honestly state on behalf of my office that we do not always charge everything that we can readily prove. But with respect to the machine guns in this case, yes, the government presented no evidence that these particular weapons, as fully assembled, had previously moved to in interstate commerce.
Or any subset that would have made them machine guns. You know, like you said, the receiver is
is a gun. Sure. So presumably the receiver of a machine gun is a machine gun.
Correct, Your Honor.
Or so not only have they not traveled, but nor any part of them that amounted to a machine gun, or it was illegal to transport across.
That's correct, Your Honor. For the court's information.
So doesn't that go contrary to Rambo?
No, Your Honor.
Rambo seems to say pretty clearly. It says you've got to have illegal. What is the language they use? In other words, there can be no unlawful possession under Section 922-0 without an unlawful transfer.
And then backing up, Your Honor, I'm looking at.
It does say that.
I don't deny that, Your Honor. And then what I would read to the court is.
Wise, because it's in there. That's wise.
I really want to hear his answer.
And backing up immediately before that, citing with approval the Fifth Circuit decision in Kurt, the court also says, by regulating the market in machine guns, including regulating intrastate machine gun possession, Congress has effectively regulated the interstate trafficking in machine guns. There is a rational basis to conclude that federal regulation of intrastate incidents of transfer and possession is essential to effective control of the interstate incidents of such traffic.
Your Honor, okay, where are you reading from?
Let's put my. Page 952, Your Honor.
Well, I read you from the very top of page 952, so you said you're backing off from there. I read you the very first words on page 952.
Correct.
So you don't mean backing off, you mean?
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor. After that section, if we go then, so if we read the next, after the words that the court just cited, the court says, again, citing Kirkwood approval, in effect, the ban on such possession is an attempt
well,
to.
You're reading the same thing again without telling me where. Okay? Next paragraph. Same paragraph. Here, so many lines down.
Okay. Page 952, Your Honor. The court read the first sentence on page 952.
Right.
I refer the court to the remainder of that paragraph, and then also the next paragraph, the second half of the paragraph starting out by regulating the market in machine guns. And the way the government reads the Kirk decision is it says that it recognizes that there are times that one may be involved with simple intrastate possession of machine guns, but that when one looks at the nature of machine guns, that it's, in this particular case, because of the nature of machine guns, it is appropriate for the court to regulate, to reach intrastate possession of machine guns, because by eliminating or not allowing people to possess machine guns solely intrastate, that eliminates the interstate demand for such weapons. And what we're talking about here, Your Honors, we're talking about machine guns. We're not talking about slide rules.
You know, I have no clue what you just said. Maybe you should try again. The sentence that I read you, it says you can't have unlawful possession without an unlawful transfer. Okay? That's where we start. And then it seems to me the rest of the paragraph just explains. It says, look, once they've been transferred, when they've crossed state lines, then you regulate them within the state because that affects interstate commerce because they've already crossed state lines. But I don't see where anything that you talk about there, that talks about there, speaks to a situation where there is no transfer of state lines,
Your Honor,
across state lines, or how it could be in light of Lopez.
Your Honor, if you look at the next paragraph, starting out by the sentence that says, by regulating the market in machine guns, including regulating intrastate machine gun possession.
Was this prosecution under Q or O?
922-0, Your Honor. 922-0 was the machine gun ban. 922-Q was the handgun in the school zone law.
So my understanding of your argument is there is no interstate transfer required by 922-0.
Correct, Your Honor.
To make the crime.
Correct.
And so then, therefore, the question is whether this statute valid under Lopez. And
correct.
Then your argument is Rambo says this is a valid regulation of interstate commerce for the reasons you just said, and therefore no interstate transfer is required.
That's correct,
okay.
Your Honor.
I got your argument.
But it seems when they you get back to where Judge Kaczynski is, if you read the paragraph beginning the prohibition of possession.
Yes, Your Honor.
Says Section 922-0, on the other hand, prohibits the possession of all machine guns illegally transferred. Now, it does say it regulates the possession of a weapon in a specified geographic area. But in those cases, we had a transfer. There was no question about in the next case, I think they had a purchase at a gun show or something like that. So you had a transfer. And I think what you're saying is if you show possession of a prohibited weapon under O, that's all you need to show.
Yes, Your Honor. But a unique prohibited weapon in that it's a machine gun.
Right.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right.
And then also the government cited a number of cases in other circuits also along this line. The government's not aware of any case, a 922-0 case, which has allowed the simple intrastate possession of a machine gun. The courts have read 922-0 to reach machine guns regardless of whether or not the individual weapon had moved in interstate or foreign commerce or been transferred.
So that would reach his argument that since he built it himself, there was no transfer of the weapon. There was a transfer of early components.
That's correct. For the court's information, this Sten gun generally, the Sten guns were manufactured by the British during World War II. They were manufactured in very large quantities. Again, the Sten gun has a very similar tube as to the tube I demonstrated to the court. Under federal law, the tube is the receiver. The tube in and of itself is a machine gun. So the parts without the tube are not subject to regulation. So
are these were original Sten guns or replicas?
What we have, Your Honor, is the defendant was ordering Sten gun parts, but not the receiver. He received the Sten gun parts interstate and then was assembling a Sten gun-like device. There was testimony presented at trial that these Sten guns were not a classic British Sten gun. What they were is it had some Sten gun parts. It had a Sten gun tube, and then it had components that the defendant was also using on his 50 caliber rifles. So some of the components on the 50 caliber rifles were the same that were on the Sten. So the defendant was modifying his Sten guns to add some of his 50 caliber rifle components.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're out of time. And a minute for a rebuttal.
No,
I don't know. Okay, case will stand submitted.
Thank you.
Next case is United States versus Espinosa.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Ross Fisselman. I represent the appellant in this matter. I also represented Mr. Espinosa in the district court below during trial. The first issue I'd like to talk about concerns the Sixth Amendment right to compulsory process. We subpoenaed a witness to testify. That witness failed to show up. The judge...
What was the proof that the witness you wanted was actually the one subpoenaed?
The proof was that, well, first of all, I want to make something clear to this Court, which is that we followed all the proper procedures.
Well, that may be. That can maybe be part of your argument. But you –
What proof did we present to the district court?
That you had subpoenaed the guy you wanted.
Well, first of all, I made a proffer to the Court that we subpoenaed Tony Arambula at 712 Bradfield, California, in Los Angeles, California, and I am an officer of the Court. And I based that evidence on my investigate. We also called as a witness Brenda Leyva, who
had not served him.
No, she called him on the phone and reminded him of continuing obligation. And it is a law of this Court that once you've been served with a subpoena, that you have a continuing obligation to obey that subpoena. I expected him to
was
show.
Was the return on the subpoena introduced as an exhibit?
At the time of trial? No. It was submitted. It is part of the excerpt of record.
Right. I've looked at it in the excerpt, but my question is, was that submitted at the time of trial?
It was not submitted at the time of trial. I want to direct attention to the excerpt of record at page 92, where the Court says, this is the next day after it becomes clear that the Court is not going to get the marshals to arrest Mr. Arambula, and is also going to strike any testimony regarding the fact that he was subpoenaed. And the Court says, we don't even know for sure if you subpoenaed the right person. If you have the actual subpoena, Mr. Visselman, that's me, I do, Your Honor, the Court. But even though he has been subpoenaed, that in and of itself, well, I'll put it this way, you can say you subpoenaed him. The Court, at least my understanding of what the Court's saying there is that he's accepting my proffer that we actually subpoenaed him, which to me means that we served him with a subpoena. On page 95 of the excerpt.
How difficult would it have been for you to show that he had been served a subpoena?
I had it in my brief.
You had the investigator who had already testified, right?
Right.
Who had done this, and you didn't ask him at that time.
No. I used to work. Let me give a little background.
The answer is you didn't ask.
I used to work at.
You know what your life history.
I'm not giving my life history.
You didn't ask him at that time.
You didn't ask.
No. Yeah. Right. Yes. Okay. I didn't ask that. I did ask for a continuance, however, to call that
way. You're jumping ahead. At the time he testified, you didn't ask him this question.
No.
You could have. You didn't.
I guess I could have. At that time, I expected the witness to show up. I didn't. Well, I don't know why I have.
You want to take time agreeing with me?
Yes.
You want to take more minutes?
No.
You could have asked him. You didn't ask him.
Right.
Okay. Then you had the next day on the stand, you had Leyva, who said, I talked to him, and I also talked to the original investigator, and the original investigator told me he served a subpoena. I talked to Leyva, right?
Right.
Now, at that point, how difficult would it have been to put the investigator back on the stand?
Very easy. He works two blocks away.
So why didn't you just call him at that point?
Because the judge wouldn't let me. I asked at least three times.
Well, you asked for continuance, but it seems to me if you got another witness, how long would it take for the guy to come into court?
I said to the judge, do you want me to get my investigator? And he said, no, I'm not. It's too late in the game for that.
I had the impression that you were asking for a continuance just to put him on the stand.
Well, no. I did not ask for a continuance to put him on the stand. I did say to him a couple of times, I said, should I call my investigator? I say, for example, on page 81, I say, should I call my investigator from Federal Defenders? And then the Court says, I am not saying you didn't serve him. I don't know who you served, but I think you made the point that you tried to get him. And I said, okay. Then the next day, so to me, that means that the Court is accepting my proffer that the investigator actually did serve him. Then the next day, the government springs this motion, moves to strike all the testimony that Tony Arambula, the witness, ever subpoenaed. And then I say, Your Honor, it sounds to me like the government is arguing some kind of bad faith. We asked to reopen the case so I can call my investigator who subpoenaed him. I asked to do that yesterday. We would ask to reopen the case. We can say that that person, my investigator, talked to Tony Arambula, and that is the Tony Arambula who is present, Mr. Espinosa.
Did you make a proffer as to what Tony Arambula was going to testify to?
I did. That's also in your excerpt of record in my ex parte application. Tony Arambula was the man who drove down with my client on the day that he was arrested, spent time with him in Mexico. He was also the person that owned the car that my client was arrested in.
And he's going to get on the stand and say, you know, yeah, I had this car full of drugs, and Mr. Espinosa took it and drove across the border with my illegal drugs. Fat chance.
I expected Mr. Arambula to get on the stand and
take the fifth.
No, and to testify, and that once he testified, the jury, that testimony would have been helpful to my client, and the jury would have acquitted my client. I anticipated that Mr. Arambula's testimony would have helped Mr. Espinosa.
I'm still confused as to did Mr. Arambula ever say, was your proffer that Arambula had said to your investigator, this is what I'm, you know, this is what I know, this is what
well,
I say?
Well, at the beginning of the case, I made some investigations. I made an investigation, and that was based on my investigation, was that Mr. Arambula, I based it on what my investigator told me, what my client told me, what the discovery from the government provided me, that Mr. Arambula was a critical witness in this case. I filed my ex parte applications about 6 months before trial.
Okay, but the idea that he would actually testify other than taking the fifth, I don't understand where you get that idea.
Well, I don't subpoena people. I mean, I didn't subpoena a witness with the expectation that he would take the fifth. I subpoenaed.
What else is he going to do?
He would corroborate my client's story, that my client's testimony that he owned the car, that he drove down with him on the day, he would.
This is the car that's full of drugs on that day.
In the trunk.
And you think? Okay, all right.
Wouldn't he then have been confessing to having had the drugs in the trunk?
Well, this is all speculation. I mean, would he have? I don't know. I mean, I tell you what, if he was on the stand and he lied, he would be subject to cross-examination, and the jury would have.
Why is he going to take the fifth?
Which is why the jury would have had an opportunity to decide the case based on the testimony that was presented to it. At this point, the jury didn't have any testimony. I'd like to also point out.
Isn't the most likely thing that would have happened is that he'd taken the fifth? He gets on the stand and says, I'm not going to talk about this.
I don't think this Court can speculate as to whether someone's going to take the fifth. I certainly don't think that the client's right to the Sixth Amendment compulsory process should rest on some judge's speculation that an exculpatory critical witness will take the Fifth Amendment.
I wouldn't want that either, but we're the best you've got, you know. If not judge's speculation, who else? Because that's what we have.
We have the Constitution, which says that you have a right to compulsory process. What made this case.
Assuming that's the case, you still have to show prejudicial error.
Well,
you have to show it made a difference.
Sure. Well, I think I can do that.
The most likely thing that would have happened is that the guy would have gotten on the stand and, played the Sphinx. Can we really say that your client would have been.
Well,
off
sure.
With that.
I'd like to point something out. I think this also addresses this Court's concerns with whether he would take the fifth at all. And that is what makes this case particularly egregious, which is on page 109 of the excerpt of record, which is the government's rebuttal argument to the jury, which was explicitly allowed by the Court. Now, there has been a lot of talk about Tony. Where is Tony? We don't know where Tony is. We don't know if Tony even exists. It's pretty convenient for the defendant to take the stand and blame it all on Tony and then say, well, he didn't show up. Therefore, you can infer that Tony is the guilty one. Ladies and gentlemen, there's absolutely no evidence of Tony knowing about this and coming down here. In fact, the judge has instructed you that testimony that Stone has been subpoenaed, that is not evidence. So the government and its rebuttal witness is telling the jury, this guy doesn't even exist. This is a figment of the defense's imagination. If he would have showed up, even if he took the fifth, the jury would have seen that he did exist and that he wasn't a figment of our imagination. This was a witness that by the government's rebuttal argument, became even more critical.
Did Mr. Carey testify that the car was owned by a Tony Arambula?
No. The registered owner of the car was actually somebody else.
Okay. So he testified it wasn't your client's car.
It was definitely not my client's car.
Okay, so that evidence was already in that it wasn't his car.
That it wasn't my client's car. Oh, yeah, that was probably in during the government's case in chief.
Okay.
It was not my client's car. It was the registered owner of the car was somebody else. Mr. Kyrie was one of my first witnesses. Then my client testified. Then there was a 15-minute recess during which I went out to see if Mr. Arambula was present. When he wasn't present, that's when I called Ms. Leyva. By that time, Mr. Kyrie had already gone back to the federal defender building, which is two blocks away. There's another issue I'd like to talk about, which concerns the text. In its rebuttal, the government presented evidence of a text printout. A text stands for Treasury Enforcement Computerized System, I believe. And the text printout is basically a computerized printout produced by Customs, which lists, which documents the times that cars enter and leave the United States. It does this with a license plate. The defendant, Mr. Espinosa, testified that he entered Mexico at about 7 o'clock that evening, and the government in its rebuttal presented evidence that their computerized printout indicated that he actually entered Mr. Espinosa testified that he entered Mexico at 2 o'clock. The government testified that the text printout indicated that he entered Mexico at 7 o'clock. Text evidence is generally admissible. I agree with that under the Orozco case. However, the Orozco case says that although this evidence is generally admissible, this computerized document is generally admissible, it still is subject to a reliability finding by the court. And there needs to be a proper foundation laid for it. In this case, the judge found that there was no proper foundation laid for this document. The judge says, I think you could have laid a better foundation, but you didn't. So I'm excluding the document from entering into evidence. The jury cannot consider this document.
What more should they have done than what they did on the foundation?
Well, if you look at their foundation, they really didn't do anything to lay a foundation except for just explain what that computerized printout is. For example, in Orozco, well,
what do you think they should have done besides that?
In Orozco, the court points out that there was a verification procedures. In Orozco, there was testimony that an inspector types in the license plate number into a computer, and then the primary inspector, this is for cars coming into the United States, verifies that the number on the computer screen is actually the number of the car that the person meets at the booth. In this case, you're talking about outgoing cars going into Mexico. There are no inspectors on those outgoing booths, at the outgoing lanes. There was no evidence that any inspector typed in license plate numbers when they leave into the United States. So there would need to be some foundation laid as to where they get these license plate numbers when you have a car that's leaving the United States into Mexico. So that I think that would be critical, and there also would be it also be necessary to double check that information to show a foundation for how it was verified. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, you got it.
Morning, Your Honor. James Fazio of the United States. In this matter, I'll address the issues as presented by defense counsel. Beginning first with the subpoena issue. The defendant is responsible for production of his witnesses, and the court is justified in refusing to issue an arrest warrant unless the defendant adequately proves that we have actual service of process. There was no evidence of process, no evidence at trial adduced that service of process had actually been affected. In fact, it wasn't produced.
The judge kind of signaled that he believed Mrs. Leyva and that it wasn't necessary to prove anything else to defense counsel.
I have a separate comments on that. First, I would say I'm not sure whether the court is in a position actually to waive the service of process requirement. I think it actually made clear in the record that if the government had seen fit to waive that requirement, it could have done so, but that was not the case. So I would begin with that. And then I would say that I think the district court may have miscommunicated in some event, or they weren't on the same page, because it did draw a distinction between actually issuing a subpoena, you know, which it had done validly on two prior occasions. There's a difference between issuing the subpoena and actually proving valid service of process. And it did say, you didn't prove that. They didn't prove that. They didn't produce the service of process until sentencing, 7 months after trial. What they did do was put on the two investigators.
But they did ask for time to bring the investigator in to testify that he did serve it.
They had that opportunity, Your Honor. I would agree. They had two opportunities to do that.
No, they asked for time. They said, should I bring the investigator in? And the judge said no. Time must go on. I thought made somewhat odd statements as well. You know, I've seen this with the government. If the government's witness isn't here, the case goes on. But, of course, the government has the FBI and the Treasury and all sorts of agents out there. They don't need a bench warrant in order from the court to force somebody into court. They just stand a couple of agents down and they can haul somebody into court. So I thought that analogy was inapt on the district court's part.
I will respond.
Why in the world would the court not say, okay, if you have service of process, and this is a key witness, you've got an hour to bring the witness into court to show that half an hour. Or, you know, you put on your next witness, but you have leave to make a phone call to have the witness brought into court, and the witness better be here before your defense case is up. Why isn't that the appropriate thing for the court to do when confronted with a request by a party that my witness, who's on the subpoena, didn't show up?
If I may, Your Honor, the decision by the district court whether to reopen the case or to permit a continuance for additional evidence is well within it's an abuse of discretion. It's well within the court's discretion whether it should do that. And we may think that that should have been what was done, but it is an abuse of discretion standard. Here, defense had two opportunities through two different witnesses, and they testified within two witnesses of each other. Clearly, the defendant knew that service of process was going to be an issue, yet they chose not to ask the appropriate questions of the investigator who actually did the subpoena service, or allegedly did the subpoena service.
How did the defense know that? In other words, I take it in this trial the witnesses were probably excluded from the courtroom. So defense counsel's in the courtroom doing his job. He may not know that Tony isn't there until he goes to look for him. So why would he ask the investigator on the first trip up, did you subpoena Tony? No reason to. He doesn't know Tony isn't there.
Well, he did see fit to ask the second investigator, Brenda Leyva, whether they asked him the subpoena questions. And then the judge was...
That later?
That was two witnesses later. I mean...
But there wasn't that after the question of attendance of Tony had come up.
If defendant was aware that service of process would be an issue, as well he did at this point, because he asked the questions not having known whether Mr. Rambula was going to show up. He asked those same questions of the witness the very next witness.
I thought that Brenda was put on the stand after Tony's non-attendance was discovered.
No, that's not true. It was after Carrie, I believe, was that examination. And they chose, you know, they asked the questions, she didn't have any idea whether he was served. It's my understanding, she said, it's, quote, my understanding that Tony Rambula had been served, but she didn't know when he was served, how he was served, where he was served. She testified that she had simply called up a Mr. Tony Rambula and reminded him of his continuing obligation to testify. And the judge observed, well, that's hearsay. We don't know who you contacted. You had the investigator who actually, allegedly, did the service of process two witnesses ago. You didn't ask him? You knew this was going to be an issue. You didn't ask him whether he actually served, when it was served?
No, but how is he going to know it's an issue? Until the witness is called and is not present, how does he know it's an issue?
I don't understand. The judge seemed like an awfully big hurry. The first time the witness gets called, the witness is not there, and they say, look, we expected the witness to be here. He's not here. We've had an investigator talk to him and remind him of the need to be here. We expected him to be here. He's now not here. We want to prove up that he is on the subpoena and ask for a warrant to have him brought in. I don't understand why. And then you think it was appropriate for you to then argue to the jury that this person doesn't even exist when you know pretty well that, in fact, there was a isn't that sort of the kind of pushing past the proper and ethical or that government lawyers shouldn't be doing? Whatever they were able to prove in court, I mean, you knew darn well that in fact, tried to get this witness in.
Your Honor, I actually wasn't the trial attorney in that matter, but
whoever the trial attorney was.
I would say that there was no improper argument on that basis. On the state of the record that then existed, there was no evidence that Tony Arambula, or he, I don't know how many Tony Arambulas there may have been, there was no evidence that he actually had been served.
The government is not bound simply by the state of the record. It's also bound by what it knows to be the truth. And it can't make an argument, even if something is not available in the record, that the government lawyers knows to be untrue. And for the government lawyer to stand there and say, argue, oh, there was not even such a person, you should infer there's no such a person, but you know damn well there was such a person. Whoever the government lawyer knew was there, knew there was such a person, to make the defendant out to be a liar in ways that the government lawyer knew was not the case. It's really not appropriate conduct.
I'm not sure that whether on the state of the record at that time, whether that's the case. I mean,
you know, keep talking about the state of the record. Fine. Did you hear what I said?
I did.
Okay. So why do you keep talking about the state of the record?
There was no valid service of process ever issued. We don't know if, in fact, they had served a Tony Arambula, the Tony Arambula with whom he had allegedly gone down to Mexico with, or anything. So they're suggesting that we don't know who this guy was. We don't know if they got the right guy. I think that was the tone that he had meant to convey at the time. I don't think that is an appropriate.
Say quite a bit more. We don't know there is such a guy.
It was not deemed to be improper at that time, and I think that because
well,
they
course,
had not.
Well, it's never been deemed to be improper. Did you ever read Kujayan?
I'm sorry?
Did you ever read Kujayan? You should. Good for every U.S. attorney to read Kojayan. The guy stood right there. So we didn't mean to be improper. We told the district judge a fib, but we didn't mean for it to be improper.
Well, I would still submit that I don't believe it's improper. Perhaps we have a disagreement on that, whether it was or was not improper. I don't think it was.
You know, we had a disagreement with the cynic, too. Guess who won on that one? But I don't understand. Once the witness does not show up, tell me one more time in plain English why it is not an abuse of discretion for a district judge to fail to allow the short amount of time that is needed for the defendant to bring a witness into court to prove up that the witness is under subpoena and that therefore the defendant is entitled to a court's assistance in bringing the witness into court. Why is the defendant, once he makes that discovery, not entitled to a very brief period of time to allow for him to present that proof? Why is it an abuse of discretion to deny that to a defendant?
I will answer that. We've got to consider the context in which this question is being asked. There were two proofs of service allegedly produced in the record. They are dated August 7th and August 28th, 2001. Neither of those are the trial date in this case, which is February 5th, 2002. That's several months later. Now, given that great time span we're talking about, and the significance, this Tony Arambula being the so-called critical witness, having had so much time elapse, we would expect that, well, the defense counsel had seen fit to issue a second subpoena for this August 28th date. Why not issue another one? Why not make darn well sure that if you knew he was a critical witness, you should have produced him. You should have asked the questions that were of the investigator who actually did the service to confirm that, in fact, we had properly served this guy. You had two witnesses to do it.
I don't understand what you're saying. I asked you a question, and you've said all sorts of things that Why is it not an abuse of discretion? Okay, just listen to it one more time, okay? Mm-hmm. And that'll be that. If you don't answer this time, I'm not going to ask it again. Witness fails to show up. Defendant claims he can prove up with a much short delay that the witness was under subpoena. Why is it not an abuse of discretion for a district judge to fail to give a short period of time, maybe just a matter of hour or two at the most, for the defendant to bring that witness into court to present whatever evidence may be available on the question of whether the witness was under subpoena?
I would.
Why is it?
Okay. I understand that. Two answers. He already had two bites.
Just give me one.
He had two bites of the apple. He had two witnesses to do it, and he didn't do it. We don't know that a third bite would have been sufficient. And he waited until the very last day.
Were those witnesses before the witness was called, and after the witness was called and failed to show up?
They were both before.
Okay. So, in other words, from the time that he discovers the witness is called as does not show up, okay, that's the point he discovers he has a problem. Okay? Why is it not an abuse of discretion for the district court to fail to give him enough time to prove, short amount of time to come, bring a witness in to prove that he has the witness under subpoena, the witness has a legal obligation to come into court that was now violated?
Your Honor, they had the witness in court who was already on the stand, and he could well have had, he had an ample opportunity to demonstrate that he hadn't served, but they didn't do it.
Okay. Do you disagree with your opponent that he made a proffer to the district judge of proof of service by calling the investigator back to the courtroom? Did your opponent do that?
I don't disagree with that.
All right. Now, usually, in the courts I've been in, a proffer by a counsel tells the court, I'm prepared to prove this, Your Honor. So for purposes of the proceeding right here, right now, I ask you to take this as a given for purposes of what we do from here. So I'm offering to prove to you that this investigator served Mr. Arambula, and I'll get him back here if you want. And the district court never said, I don't believe it, I want to see the witness. He went on from that, which to me takes it as a given, that the court said, yeah, you can prove that if I allow you to. I'm just not going to let you. Now, what's wrong with that as an explanation of what was going on in the courtroom?
Well, I'm not sure it actually accepted the proffer. I know that a proffer was given, but I don't know that he necessarily agreed with that.
But he didn't
go behind it.
He didn't go behind it. My experience is, unless if the lawyer gets up and tells the judge, Your Honor, I'm going to proffer proof that the sun will not come up tomorrow, the judge is going to say, I think you better prove that one. But if he wants to make a proffer that I have a witness that I can produce to prove X, and the judge doesn't take him up on it, then he has accepted that proffer. Said, okay, I believe you. You have that witness. Let's go on from there. Isn't that what the court did? He went on?
Right. He did.
Right. And so he accepted counsel's proffer. That's what proffers do. You build on that as a fact for purposes of what you're doing. So why wasn't it abuse of discretion to accept the proffer but not give the counsel a chance to follow through?
Again, I would say that he's had two bites of the apple. He had two witnesses on the stand that could have proven service. He didn't do so. He asked questions of the witness who didn't serve, but he didn't ask questions of the investigator who did serve. Why not? And if it's such a significant issue, why don't you have the proof of service right here? Why did it take you 7 months later to actually produce the proof of service? It didn't come out until sentencing, September 5th.
Can I ask you a question? Assuming that we found he made a proper showing of service, are you dead, or do you have any other backup argument?
Well, I mean, I think Your Honor's hit on it earlier. I'm not sure that would have gone anywhere because
you didn't add an alternative argument to your brief. You seem to totally rely on he didn't make a showing of proper service. So, what is your actual backup argument if you lose on that, or do you have none?
I mean, I don't know that Tony would have actually taken the stand. I think he would have, I'm not sure. I think he would have taken the Fifth. I don't know. I mean, we're speculating there.
You made it harder for your colleague to argue, oh, there's no such person.
Yes, I would agree.
Even if he takes the Fifth, it certainly would have helped. It would certainly would have helped defense lawyer argue, say, look, this corroborates my story. Here's a guy. We asked him about the car. He won't say anything about it. Why? Because, of course, he knows there's drugs in there. I mean, it's not as good as having him testify and say it's me, but it's a lot better than having nobody there and having the government say, and having the court instruct you can't even talk about the subpoena, and have the government say, oh, the guy doesn't even exist.
Is he allowed to call him if he knows he's just going to plead the Fifth?
I'm sorry?
Is he allowed to call him if he knows he's just going to plead the Fifth?
Is there any law? I don't know. That never was briefed.
You can't call a defendant, but you can call him. You can call a witness, sure.
You can call a witness.
You can call him just to make him plead the Fifth.
It's possible. At least you'd know he was there. At least the jury would understand that someone else was there.
Okay, so then you are relying solely on lack of the subpoena, nothing else. You have no backup argument.
No. I mean, I don't really know that.
Are you going to be counsel on retrial?
I'm sorry?
Are you going to be counsel on retrial?
Probably not.
Okay. We've got 3 minutes and 16 seconds.
I'll address briefly the text argument. There is an evidentiary ruling that, again, is reviewed for abuse of discretion. And even if there is error, this Court should not reverse unless.
I'm sorry, which one is this?
This is the text argument, the text document. The Treasury
that was
report.
A weird ruling. Now, this guy, judge, made a lot of weird rulings. He says, I don't admit it. I find it unreliable, I think he said. But then he lets the agent testify about it. I don't understand how you can allow a witness to testify about something that you've just ruled is itself inadmissible.
I agree that is peculiar. And it's.
It's an error.
Unless there's some showing that the witness perhaps has some independent recollection of the facts in that document.
We're standing out there.
Right.
And he just remembered the license plate.
Right. I would agree. I mean, that seems like it's very peculiar, if not error. But if it's error, it's harmless error. I mean, we have very strong independent evidence of guilt. The defendant was the driver and sole occupant of a vehicle containing over 350 pounds of marijuana worth over $280,000. He was nervous at primary. And perhaps most importantly, he gave a full and detailed confession.
Was there actually enough foundation for the text document or not?
I don't think there was. I don't think there was. I mean, it was supposed to come in as a business document or an 8038. For whatever reason, trial counsel did not lay an adequate foundation. Was it made at or near the time, you know, by its person that has personal knowledge? I would agree that inadequate foundation was laid. But even if there were error, again, it's harmless error. I mean, we've got the driver Solakin, we've got the Barbosa. There's several cases that hold that knowledge can be inferred from possession of a large amount of drugs. We have nervousness in a primary, which is also a telltale sign giving indications of consciousness of guilt, and we have the detailed confession. So apart and aside from the text document, we have tons of evidence of supporting the conviction. So I think it was harmless error.
Thank you.
To build on something Judge Rustani said with respect to the subpoena, I think that the government is dead if they rely on the proof of service. The government has conceded that the error was not harmless, and they also waived it in their brief. So they are relying solely on the facts.
How do you get past the harmless error argument? Look, he confessed. He gave a full, complete confession. He was found with the drugs. He was nervous at secondary. Why does any of this other stuff matter? Primary. I'm sorry. He was nervous at primary.
Right. I assume this Court is saying harmless error with respect to both the text and the failure to subpoena.
I think everything.
Yeah. Well. First of all, with the failure to subpoena, that's a constitutional issue. So it has it's a much higher standard of harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt. Like I said, the government conceded to this Court that that they have no argument that it would be harmless error. So I think this Court has to defer to the U.S. Attorney on that basis, that it's not harmless. The reason why I don't think it's harmless for this Court's comfort is you can rely on United States v. Velarde-Gomez, which is an en banc decision which had the guy testify that he was the sole occupant of a drug containing a significant amount of marijuana. And the Court in that case, an en banc court, said that was not harmless error. There are confession cases tried in the Southern District of California which juries acquit. Not all juries believe the agents when they testify that defendants confess. And, in fact, it was controversial in this case. So I just...
Did the defendant deny the confession during his testimony?
Yes. He said that the agents misunderstood him.
It wasn't documented.
There was no tape recording of the confession. It was just based on the agent's memory, basically, of what was said.
His argument was, I didn't understand what they were saying to me. I don't understand English very well. And then there was all this testimony about how good his English was.
Right.
Which wasn't much. Okay.
Right. I mean, it was that was essentially what it was about. It was controversial, and I think this Court can rely on.
He doesn't say I didn't say it. He says what he says is my English wasn't good, and then they prove that he's the jail interpreter, that his and that he speaks very good English.
Yeah. Essentially, that was what was offered at trial. The controversy was whether he actually confessed or not. Instead, I knew that there was marijuana in the car. That was what was controversial. I think that having Tony Arambula show up and say, this is my car. I am a friend. I know him. Just saying pretty easy stuff. I don't know if he'd have to take the fifth on, yes, I know who this person is, yes, I exist. He doesn't need to take the fifth. He wouldn't need to take the fifth to say that. The government suggested that, I think when the government...
But if you were Tony Arambula's lawyer, you would not have advised them to say, yes, that was my car, we were hanging out in TJ... right before he went back with the car laden full of drugs. I don't think these are the things that you, as Romulus lawyers, would have told him, go ahead to the court and talk about them.
I don't know. I mean, maybe Tony Arambula felt so overwhelmed by this that he would feel the need to confess.
I've seen it happen once.
Yes.
I've seen it happen once.
The
guy comes to the court and says, it was me, not him. What happened? They arrested him right out of the courtroom.
Right, and look, I
happened on Perry Mason all the time.
And that's what I assumed was going to happen in this case. Look, he was a witness. I expect him to testify and to tell the truth to the jury. The government argued to the court, it's inappropriate. The defense can come up with anybody named Tony. Ask him to come, and then raise the inference that this is the Tony guy committed the crime. When it became clear to me that the court was not going to allow me to reopen my case or subpoena or get Tony to testify, I changed my strategy. And my strategy was, he didn't show up, blame him. Blame him and say, look, he didn't show up. He's obviously guilty. He disobeyed. He disregarded a court order. I think that's perfectly permissible for me to argue. The judge said no. He said, stay away from the subpoena. The subpoena is not evidence. Inferentially, I think you can say we expected Tony to show, but you can't. You can say you expected Tony to show, but I want you to stay away from the subpoena. I don't understand what that means. But when I tried to argue, look, we expected him to show up, the government objected, and it was sustained. I was not able to argue that Tony was obviously guilty because he failed to show, yet the government was able to argue, don't believe the defense. Because how do we even know Tony exists?
You're over time. Thank you. We're going to take a 5-minute break. And we need 5 minutes.
Okay, I'm going to set it to 5 minutes.